afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. This week, we are in the throes of Father's Day weekend, and just going to end by the time this airs, and have a brother on with me today who I met recently here in Orlando through a mutual associate and friend, and had a chance to just sit down and have a conversation with him. And a gentleman with a story that's going to really be inspirational in my view, a man of deep faith and one that speaks very highly of that relationship that he has with God. So that's going to be very interesting to weave into this and his career and all the things that that he has accomplished and the things that he's currently doing. So, ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, I welcome to the podcast this week, Mr. Philip Laws. Philip, how are you, sir?
Good morning, brother. I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing good. Doing good. Well, once again, thanks for joining me on this podcast. As we shared off air, you know, this podcast is really about trying to get people to see a different station in life and understanding a station in life, their station in life, but more importantly, to envision another station for themselves based on the lived experiences of others. So as I said before, there are no preset questions. I just ask an open-ended question, and before you know it, the hour is gone. So if you're ready, we could just jump right in.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. All right. Well, tell us, who is Philip Laws and his early years, his family, his foundation that grounded him to be the man that he is today?
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, I'm a father. You know, I'm a husband. You know, we have three children. We have twins, boy and girl twins. We have an older daughter as well. And I've been married to my soulmate for 32 years. So now let me rewind. So I was born and raised in Chicago. You know, I left Chicago like in 1990. Had a chance to go. Let me even go back further than that, because I left Chicago on a football scholarship before I got married to University of Kentucky. You know, had a chance to play football there, played a year. I got hurt, played middle linebacker. You know, my family wasn't financially able to send me to school. So, but I was a good enough academic athlete that Southern University in Baton Rouge picked up my scholarship. So I was able to go to that powerful HBCU and matriculate with my bachelor's degree. Subsequently went on and got my master's degree when I moved out and got to Florida and took all of my executive leadership classes and so forth at Harvard University. I cut my teeth in the industry working with Mobil Oil Corporation. That's what got me in Florida. So 1990, I moved down here, helped them expand that brand. Did that for like 4 or 5 years. Actually, it was 3 or 4 years. Then I went over to jump into the pharmaceutical industry. Worked in that industry. This Japanese pharmaceutical firm was trying to get a foothold on the U.S. So I had to help them build out their sales force. Spent like 15 years in that industry. And then pharmaceutical companies, as you know, or may not know, they make a lot of their money on the compound. So once that branded medication, quite frankly, becomes market saturated because of generic penetration, then they restructure, downsize, right size, you know, go out of business, back and forth. So great experience, you know, learning how to manage, coach and train and develop people, how to run a business, if you will. I had a chance to go work with Starbucks Coffee Company after that, an amazing organization on their business development side. You know, I always say, well, people live, work, and play. My role was to really manage the highest volume entities within the organization. That's the hotels, the casinos, the airlines, to, you know, place the brand outside and help expand outside the retail footprint, which is a hallmark of that brand. Did that, then I went over a chance to relocated from here, went up to DC, came back to Florida, you know, and I had a chance to go work with Amazon on their global diversity, equity, inclusion standpoint, one of the largest companies in the world. Great, great opportunity to really see things from a global standpoint. So I say all that to say that I kind of grew up in corporate America. You know, you look at, you know, someone from Chicago, my mother was my father. You know, I had good, strong Black men around me to make sure I was doing the right thing. I wasn't a bad kid, but I had those mentors. So for me, it's always been, and I'm grateful to God that I've used the platform that I've been given to help others. Because as you and I talked about this at the end of the day, so I hope that my legacy would be that, because I'm standing on so many people's shoulders, you know what I mean, to make sure that I give back. You know, when I'm having interviews and when I'm talking to people, when I'm lecturing, they say, what are you most proud of? I'm most proud of the fact that I never compromised two things, who I am, that's being a Black man and being a Christian, and then being able to utilize that to help others, you know, at the end of the day. So that's it in a nutshell. On the personal side, like I said, man, I'm a dad, you know, I'm a father. We have amazing children. They're grown adults now, my daughters, and as well as my son. He's a missionary. He's decided to dedicate his life to God. All of them have matriculated through college. And like I said, I'm here in Florida with my soulmate. So yeah, that's it in a nutshell. We can go deeper if you want to, but for me,
I'm gonna take you all the way back. You said something that really struck me. You said your mother is your father. Can you expound on that? What does that statement mean?
Sure. So it's not too uncommon that mothers raise a lot of kids because the father, there's an absence of father, and that's not to stab because that's a broader conversation because of the why behind that. You know, you look at the strength of specifically African-American women. You know, I remember getting up in the morning. We grew up in Chicago. My view was an alley. I didn't see grass until I moved to Florida, grass and water. So I used to get up and watch my mother take that early bus, that early train, you know. So the strength of that, I think, well, I know for sure had an impact on my work ethic at the end of the day. So and when I say my mother was my father, because there was an absence of my biological dad. But God surrounded me with other strong men that were not connected to me biologically. But my mother was that strong person. Then I had other people like, you know, I would say Coach Lonnie Williams, and, you know, he was a football coach and he still is. I mean, mentors that stepped beyond and stepped in that gap. So that's what it's about. That's what I mean by that.
Mm-hmm. Any siblings? Do you have any siblings?
Yeah, biological sibling. I had one who was killed in Chicago. He was older than me, but again, God surrounded me with other men that came into my life. You know, I think about my brother, Chris Carr. I think about, you know, a lot of people that even working within the organization that you meet, but you have that kinship, you know, at the end of the day. May not be biological, but there is a symbiotic relationship. There's a natural connection. I think about, you know, Riley McPhee and Ira Brown, you know, these people that, you know, that you've been through a lot with, you know, and lifelong friends. You know, we don't see each other as much now because we all spread out, but we talk and we pray together, you know, at the end of the day. And it's like when we do come together, we've never missed a beat. So yeah, there's value in listening to God's word and then seeing who he bring into your life.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I always try to get a beat on, because when I first met you and I was introduced to you and then we sat and had a conversation, you think your thought patterns are very methodical and linear in my estimation. That requires a certain level of discipline. And you mentioned that your mom and the work ethic that you got. What was that like in the household, and how was your mom an influence there? And then getting through, say, grade school, middle school, and high school, was that always there? Was that an expectation, or is this something that you developed over time?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one, we didn't live in a house, we lived in an apartment, you know? So when people talk about the home, so that in itself creates a sense of, again, we wasn't financially well off, but there was a lot of love. So I saw how my mother worked to make sure that my brother and I had the necessities. We didn't have everything, but the necessities. We had food, we had shelter, and we had a lot of love. So that in itself is a discipline. That's the nucleus of, okay, you don't need to have a lot. You can do a whole lot with a little, but you need to take care of what you have and to be grateful, you know? So that, for me, it's about, okay, and then once you come into money and once you come into opportunity, how do you share that? Because when there's only a few, you know how to share and do a lot with a little. So that in itself, Gerald, quite frankly, I think that's the spark that for me has always stuck with me. That is a discipline. And I tell you, corporate America is a monster. It's a beast. When you, specifically from an African-American standpoint, you navigate into these predominantly, you know, different environments, how do you become disciplined? How do you understand how to not become emotional? How do you, you know, fight off the microaggressions? How do you stand up what you believe in? How do you navigate through that? That in itself creates a certain amount of discipline. You know, I always talk about it especially when I talk to young people, you can win the battle, but if you win the war, what have you gained at the end of the day? Right. Mm-hmm. So my mom, I've watched her, you know, from a third eye perspective too. And the older that she got, the more I would sit and listen to her. And it's just with my mother too, older people too, my grandmother, I sit down and talk to her. There's wisdom in doing that.
So the academic discipline. And you know, you said something that I always catch on to, because I'm a big advocate for student athletes. I do believe those two words, that's not an oxymoron. I'm one of those people that believes being an athlete and someone that's good in academics, they're mutually exclusive, but they're inextricably linked. What drove the hunger for you in that realm? Because you said you're a student athlete and scholarship and all these things. What was the driver there for you?
Yeah, because it was well, I was well conditioned in my mind before I left to go to college that this is a way out. Living in poverty, and you see certain things. I could have been a drug dealer or a gangster or dead. So when you, this is a window of opportunity for you to capture. So it was like I didn't have a fallback plan. So that put more emphasis on the academic, making sure you go to school and learn. But you know what? I'll tell you something about that, Gerald. For me, the academic piece was great, but more or less the assimilation with other people, that was the broader for me, you know, to be around a diverse group of people, to understand how people live and, you know, to see how they manage wealth or to see how they deal with situations. I think that the socialization of it, you know, just being around other people helps shape who I am. But the core, to your point, is like, hey, you're here for a purpose at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And then understanding once you get into it, you know, and you're right, student at, they are interchangeably. And you start thinking about, hey, I'm here, you know, they're picking up my scholarship, but at the same time, they're benefiting from what I'm producing from an entertainment standpoint. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I think absolutely. You're absolutely right. And when you don't have, and I'll go back to this. I mean, it's not like I could go back home. To what? You know, you got to make it. You know, you got to make it here. You know, on the academic side, meet as many people as you can, you know, to get a chance to learn from them and then socialize that to help you build your platform.
Yeah, absolutely. So sports, middle linebacker, scholarship to the University of Kentucky. That's a big deal.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, that is a big deal. So when did this sporting bug bite?
It's middle actually started,
high school.
Yeah, that's a great question, because I always give homage to it's high school. I went to Dr. Martin Luther King High School on the South Side. You know what I mean? So as I look at, you know, sports, I wasn't that serious about sports. I just had, again, another man, Coach Lonnie Williams, coming in my life. And my brother, my brother was a phenomenal athlete. And then Riley McPhee, who was like a twin of mine, who were not biologically connected, he set us down and he just, I mean, I know God brought him into our lives to shape us as men and say, listen, this is a game that can help propel you to do what you want to do. It really wasn't about sports. It was about, you know, building men. You know what I mean? How do you work with other men? How do you have conflict resolution? How do you deal with folks that you don't like? So that preparation for college was phenomenal. You know what I mean? So, and then, like I said, I went to Martin Luther King High School. That's on the South Side of Chicago. You know, it's that preparation. So it's nothing that they could have thrown at me at Kentucky that would have been difficult. You know, it's like, wait a minute. You know, this is layup compared to what I've had to go through. Ended up taking that early bus, you know, practicing two or three times, you know, buying my own uniforms. You know, I mean, it's a that discipline helped. And then having someone that wasn't biologically connected, and Coach had a staff too, Coach Smith, Coach Drummond. These are men, they weren't biologically connected to us, but they loved us. But they disciplined us and they prepared us for the world to come. So when I went to a college campus, it was, you know, sure, that was a transition from, you know, predominantly white environment to a predominantly black environment. But then you find things that you have in common with people. It was probably like 14 of us, you know, brothers, you know what I mean, at the end of the day. So the sports thing, we bonded, you know, kind of immediately. But then sports is also a equalizer. It's just, I don't want to compare it to the military, but once you've gone through some stuff with some people, then you create that bond. That kind of diminishes the differences to some degree at the end of the day.
Yeah. So you mentioned you went to Kentucky and you got hurt and then you ended up at Southern.
Yep. Southern University of Baton Rouge.
So what was the you know, I'm a Howard grad. So yeah. The HBCU experience meant quite a bit for me, especially for me coming from a foreign country. Sure. And going there on a track scholarship.
Yeah.
When you look back, and the preparation from your early years in Chicago and then going to Kentucky and then heading to Southern, what were some things that you saw that if you juxtapose them as you look back were either assets or liabilities in terms of how your preparation for the corporate world and beyond?
Yeah, that's a great question. So again, like I said, I grew up in a predominantly Black environment. So the transition was go to a predominantly white environment. That's college. That was the University of Kentucky. As I've had to compare Kentucky to Southern University is going back home to our folks. That's a predominantly Black university. So that Black experience that some people don't get a chance to gain was always there. It's a natural fit. You know, it's like going home. You know, Kentucky, when you look at a school like that, you look at the academics, you look at how it's funded, you know, the new buildings, you know, how the money, the plethora of philanthropy that's going into that, you start looking at that. But then when you go to HBCU and it's across the railroad track next to the Mississippi River, and you look at some of the decayed buildings and so forth, you see that there is a difference, you know, and whatever caused that could be a number of things, politics, money, nepotism, you know, racism and everything else. Mm-hmm. But the sense, again, the purpose, the whole purpose and reasoning why I was there, because I got hurt. I played middle linebacker. You know, I got hurt. And again, like I said, then scholarships were not like they are now, where they almost have insurance. It was you get hurt, you couldn't play, you go home, or you had somebody to pay. I had neither of them, but I was a good enough student athlete that Southern University, and that's why I do love HBCUs, was able to pick up my scholarship, you know, and I was able to matriculate, you know, so that was an opportunity. So for me to continue my education and then to graduate. So it was for me like coming home, you know, at the end of the day, because again, it was a predominantly Black university. I think that now you look at HBCUs, they've gotten more exposure as of late than they have ever, you know, how they leverage that. I would think that I would be able to, they should maximize that as best as they can from an academic standpoint. I think corporate America now is recognized, and it shouldn't have took this long. To know that, you know, individuals that's matriculating from those universities are just as qualified as others. But it's back then it was different. It was a transition, you know, quite frankly, it was a transition. HBCUs, that was not thought to be the best, you know, place for exposure, specifically trying to go to pros and so forth because of the general consensus, right? Mm-hmm. But for me, it was going home, and I'm grateful to have had that experience. And it's something that I always stay with me, you know, mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah. So you and I will have that kind of similar experience because Howard University did so much for me,
right?
Especially coming here to the States, it really mm-hmm. grounded me. And I had a coach in Coach Moultrie. Believe it or not, this podcast was birthed out of a book I wrote to tell him thanks.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So It's Easy, Son is a expression he'll use all the time. He said, look, you're making this thing too difficult. And as you said, it wasn't really about the sports. It was preparing all of us for life.
Sure.
So I want to ask you a question right here in this little segment here. When you now think about your experiences growing up, Kentucky, Southern, what would you say to young people today in terms of the preparation that you might not see them really taking? Because right now things are a little bit easier. I say that with my tongue in cheek because easy is probably subjective, right? Mm-hmm. But what would you say to a young person today that they have these devices, they have, you know, they had things we never had coming up? But how do they keep that hunger? What would you say?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, it certainly wouldn't be a blanket statement, but I would tell you, because I'm a baby boomer. So you look at Gen X, you look at the generation now, to your point, you pick up this phone. I love the fact that they have an entrepreneurial spirit. I think the purpose should be understanding why they want to experience whatever, whether it be HBCUs, whether it be a traditional, you know, white college or whatever. Where's their passion at the end of the day? You know, I grew up at a time where it was like, listen, go to school, you know, get a job, whatever. I don't believe that is the keys to success. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that young people coming up today, if they have drive and they have an entrepreneurial spirit and they're risk takers to do that, not to fall into the status quo, but mm-hmm. I would also be true to who they are. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are a Black man, woman, you know, whatever you, your culture should be extremely important to you, mm-hmm. and your religious background as well. And again, I'm not trying to tell people what to do, but I would say dream big. You know, I would say take that chance, but I would also be intentional and have a focus. Yeah. I would say, you know, identify what those goals are and do everything within your power to try to achieve those. Should you fall short, get up and do it again. You know, be very creative. You know, life is too short. I hear what you said when you say you think it's easier. They have more opportunity. You know what I mean? I think because the path, I think that's the very definition. When you start thinking about trailblazers, a lot has been done to create an environment for them to thrive at the end of the day. And it is a waste when they don't take advantage of that. That's the same thing with voting. This country is soaked with people's blood, and then you can't vote at the end of the day. So yeah, I hear exactly what you're saying. I would say dream big, take that risk. Don't be afraid of making mistakes, and don't lose who you are mm-hmm. and whose you are. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So your passion in school, and you mentioned passion core. I believe when they intersect, that's where you find your joy. But what, so you left Southern and what was next? How did you, what was entering the corporate world like? Cause you've mentioned that a couple of times.
Yeah.
That it is a monster. Yeah, those of us that's been in it, we have experienced certain things, and they made us better, not bitter. But how would you describe your time leaving Southern and the preparation that you had going into your corporate life?
Yeah, so you know, you grow when you go away from home. You grow pretty fast, specifically if you don't have a lot. You know, I wanted to make some money. You know, I got to, and our purpose, not just, my purpose was not just for me. I got to make money and send home at the end of the day. Because, you know, like I said, I used to see my mother get up and take that early bus. So as I went to college, my mother was getting older. So how can I help my family? So mm-hmm. For me, it was so important to try to position myself to start making some money to be able to support not only myself, but my others at home as well. So that was my driving force. But as I started getting into the corporate game and I moved around quite a bit because it's a pretty diverse organization, I was always looking for that next thing. You know, with Mobil Oil Corporation, make X amount of dollars, you learn these skills. Okay, I start seeing they start doing crazy stuff at the organization. What's the next opportunity? You know what I mean? It was always looking forward because, again, I can't look in the rearview mirror. You know, my goal was how do you accumulate as much wealth as I could and experience as I can to position myself so I can get a chance to really do what I wanted to do at the end of the day. You know, that's interesting, like you said, because when I say it's a monster, there's a learning curve, you know, and it doesn't necessarily have to be academic, right? It has to be with how do you assimilate with people, you know? There are certain things that you won't be able to control. You know, I got MBA and, you know, I got a lot of experience, but when I walk in certain boardrooms, people see who I am. There's so many layers you have to go through to get their acceptance or to, you know, make them feel comfortable with making decisions about you. I always wanted to be in a situation where I didn't want anybody else to be in control of my life, you know, personally or professionally. So the need to have a job or to have finances coming in was extremely important because I saw how my mom worked and my uncle Emsley worked. He used to take me. And I started working at an early age. I used to get on the paper truck with him, you know.
Oh, really?
Paper truck, yeah. I used to deliver papers with him early in the morning. We get up 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, drive papers. And I used to watch how he used to interact with anybody, with store owners. And then when I came home from college 1 year, I drove a city bus in Chicago. I had the routes on the south side and north side. And the economy of that was education.
Yeah.
You go on the south side, you know where you're at. You go on the north side, you see once you cross a certain street, there's no paper on the ground. You know, these people got doormen. And you know, so it's a, and then you get on there and you see how they act and how they look and how they dress. So yeah. I took advantage of the environment so I can kind of learn, you know, just by watching people. So by the time I got to corporate America, I had all this, like, listen, I know what you got to say, what you do, what you don't do. And then you work through that, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunately because you see people that look like you, but they're confused with who they are.
Yes.
So
yes.
That becomes a problem. That's a cancer, you know, because when you think people that that have, you would think that have went through some of the things that you went through, that they would certainly be very understanding, but they're not.
Yeah, they're not. And that's oftentimes disappointing. Something you mentioned, Chicago and going back and driving a city bus. By the way, I find that very impressive, to be honest with you. But it reminded me of a conversation I was having with a colleague right here in Orlando the other day. Yeah. And he said he went to Chicago for a conference. Mm-hmm. And he didn't know where he was going. And he was, you know, got to the taxi stand. And the taxi driver was pretty much said, you know, something to the effect, you know, be careful. You know, once you get outside of a certain area, it's like a wasteland. Mm-hmm. As someone from Chicago, how would you respond to someone saying that? Because when I heard it, it was kind of jarring. It was jarring to the individual as well. But it gets back to the point that you just made, mm-hmm. is that those of us, even that though we went through something and we have experiences of it, once we are out of it, we have a tendency to look at it with disdain. But, you know, as someone from that area, how does that hit you? How does that strike you? Especially when you hear that Chicago comes up so much, because I do believe that in every nook and cranny, whichever country you're in, neighborhood you're in, or whatever side of the tracks you grew up on, yeah. you're a person, and yeah. within you is drive, and within you are possibilities. Yeah. But oftentimes we don't try to find those diamonds in the rough, polish them up, and launch them. How would you react to that?
Yeah, I'm like you, not only disdain, that is, again, that's a person that has lost himself or never experienced that. At the end of the day, you know, Chicago will always be home to me. You know, there's a dichotomy in every city, every, like you said, nook and cranny that you go to, there's the haves and the haves not. There's, you know, there's people that have privilege and people that don't have privilege. But to me, when I look at the underserved population or the underrepresented population, I'm a product of that. As you start looking at health equity and social determinants of health, why people don't have it, you start looking at systemic racism that has plagued this company. And for you to say, you look at it and say, that's a wasteland. You know, I would say, one, what have you done to try to help that? Two, you've kind of lost yourself at the end of the day. My wife right now is in Johannesburg, South Africa. She's there for like 18 years doing some mission work with Baby Hayden. I talked to her the other night. They're like 8 hours or 6 hours ahead of us. And I said, hey, how's it going? She said, it's going okay, but it's so emotional because these babies here, they have nothing to play with. They have a glass field that we just went out and played with them, but they as happy as can be, you know, they don't have shoes. And so it's like the connection, you never should ever lose that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We are so fortunate here in the United States, even at our worst situation until they, you know, go abroad and you see that. So I would say, and again, when I hear that, I immediately kind of ignore that because they have lost touch in reality. And I don't know who this individual was that you were talking to. Maybe they've never experienced that, or maybe they have, and they just want to dismiss that. It's like slavery at the end of the day. You know, people take it lightly, but think about it. You know, if you were enslaved by a group of people or in a situation where your dignity was constantly stripped from you and everything else, and then you get out of that situation and you look back and say, well, you know, it really wasn't that bad, or that's them set of people. If you forget that, then that's a lost cause at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lost cause.
I agree. And it was interesting.
Wow.
Because the person was talking to a cab driver. The cab driver is the one that said that. And the person just looked at him and said, wow, like you said. Yes. You're in some ways lost, and that's pretty sad.
I'm gonna catch you on. So now, so the cab driver said it. So that's the other thing. It's like cultural conditioning. If that's the only thing that you've seen, you know what I mean. And I don't know, you know, if you've always just been around a toxic environment, you know, you tend to kind of believe that. You know what I mean? Hey, listen, don't do that. And he's in the service business. He'd be a taxi driver, say, watch it do that. I mean, I don't know if he's trying to find favor or whatever. Sometimes, or that's his way of, I want to get out. Think about it. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, you know, would you recommend, hey, listen, like now I go to these cities. I'm a city boy. I've been around billionaires. I don't care about that. Man, I go, I put my faded jeans on. I get on the metro. You know, I do my thing. You know, I go in the city. I go in the hood. I know, I mean, that's a comfort zone for me. But there are certain places and certain things that I see too. I don't diminish that. I'm aware of it. Like you, when you go home, Joe, you know places to go or not to go. You know what I mean? But you don't disrespect that. You don't think less of that. You know, if anything, my heart goes out. It's like, I wish I could do more. You know?
Yeah.
But brother, I don't want to go ahead. I don't want to. Yeah.
No. You're absolutely right. And I think part of the challenge, part of the challenge is I was part of a conversation about 2 weeks ago called Talking with Friends.
Okay.
And it morphed exactly into that. How do we help others? But let me ask you a pointed question they asked me. That would be a great question. What is it that a collective cannot see this? And that those of us, you know, as the Bible says, to whom much is given, much is required.
Yeah.
But it oftentimes turns into who much is given, let me go get more. Get people excited to say, look, if we find ways to invest in our young people and in I'm talking about the young people because I see them all the time in higher education.
Yeah.
That's one of the beauties of why I love higher education, because I can see these young people come in as freshmen. They know everything.
Yeah.
And by the time they're graduating as seniors, they're crying, getting that diploma.
Yeah.
They went through something, right?
Yeah.
A maturation process took place. Yeah. But in your mind, why can't others see that? Look, if a rising tide lifts all boats, we will all be better. Mm. And I'm speaking specifically in, say, our minority communities. Why do you think we can't see it that way?
Yeah, it gets back to being conditioned. You know what I mean? You start looking at the slave ships and the mass. Who really captured a lot of our people and put them on the boats? We did at the end of the day. It's not having, you can talk about crabs in the barrel, right? You start looking at that, pulling each other down, because we don't think that if you got more than I got, that ain't going to work. It's our self-hate. It's, you know, there's a part of us that's been, we have been trained to hate each other, you know, for a lack of a better word, you know, it's different though, Joe, when I think about today, because this population is quite frankly more diverse than at least I was, you know, at the end of the day. And even if there is within our own house, within the African-American community, we have so many problems. You talk about light skin, dark skin, you talk about privilege, not privilege. You know, you talk about, you know, and now, you know, from an exclusivity standpoint, if you're LGBTQ or whatever, there's so many dichotomies that's taken away from, to your point, us really collectively being together, you know. Traditionally, Black folks, I shouldn't say traditionally, a lot of times Black people come together, usually if it's a family, even family member, if it's a funeral, you know what I mean? It's like the separation of that, you know, it's so many different messages. That's why I always go back to God, because at the end of the day, that's my barometer. We got so many different mixed messages. I mean, you got children now, you know, at the end of the day, you know, and your children probably have assimilated with a more diverse group than you could ever think of at your age. Yeah. That's great, because it gives them a different perspective. They got a wider lens to look from. But the challenges will still be there because of who they are and how do they navigate through that? And how do they get help from that instead of, you know, being suppressed because of that?
Yeah.
You know, Jerry, I don't have the answer. And I'm glad. That's why I thank God that you are in the academic, because you see it and you're real and you're very authentic with them. You know, there's value in that. That's why even when I talk to people in academia, you know, they say they can't find, you know, Black teachers or Black men. Like you said, I go find a billion of them right now. You know what I mean? You need that. You know what I mean? And women too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And again, I don't want to get off topic. Hopefully that answers your question. I don't have the answer. Right? I don't. It's hard. I hate to see it. You know, I do.
Well, you know, it's a work in progress. And, you know, every day we get up, all we can do when you wake up every day, what we're faced with every day is an option or an opportunity.
Right.
And I think if we could take it, but I want to touch on your faith a little bit, because when you and I met, it obviously is something that grounds you. Can you just share what that means to you, your faith, and how that, I would say, undergirds who you are today?
Yeah, that's easy. So it's two words, everything.
Mm, okay.
Yeah. I mean, for me, everything, you know. Because salvation is free. So whether you're rich, poor, black or white, you know, it's free. So when you don't have a lot, you learn that pretty fast. So my spiritual foundation started off early. I would see my mother and grandmother and mainly my grandparents take us to church. That's free, you know, in poverty or not. To this day, I remember sitting on those hard brown wooden benches in church all day long. That's free. That has never left me, you know. Success, failure, that has never left me. I know that God is real, and I know that I'm not perfect. So that's always been something near and dear to my core. And the older that I've gotten, I've never been ashamed of it. The older I've gotten, I speak freely about that. You know, they say that's the things you shouldn't talk about, politics as well as religion in corporate America. I say what's on my mind at the end of the day, you know, because I'm not ashamed of that if they bring it up, you know. And I try not to offend anybody, but I make no apologies for speaking about who I am and whose I am. So that goes deep. And the same thing when I met you, you know, and you was very transparent about that. And we talked about our, you know, our spiritual beliefs, and it's nothing wrong with that. Some people run away from that, Gerald, but that is something that for me, that's a non-option at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. So if I was to ask you this, the highest moment or biggest success, whatever success might be, because that's a subjective thing again. And what would be you say is your biggest failure? And with the failure, how did you come back from it?
So for me, being a father and a husband at the end of the day, because the family component is extremely important. I think that I look at that as, I don't take that for granted. I'm humble with the fact that God has given me the opportunity to be both. As I think about, there are some things that I wish I should have done early on, but it's a transition when you learn early on as it relates to planning more for the future. Mm-hmm. You know, at the end of the day, you can always look back. I mean, enjoying the journey as you try. I mean, when you hustling, when you trying to make it, you know, it's sometimes you lose vision, you know. So it's like, how do you, you know, I don't know if I enjoyed the journey as much as I would have now that I'm older. Yeah. Because you have a laser focus, you know. Yeah. It's like, man, I, you know, instead of cutting that grass, you know, and trying to make sure that's squared away so I can sit down some, you know, with my daughter and my son. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, taking those walks in the rain with my wife, you know, hey, we're trying to get this. We moving back and forth, or trying to insulate the dealing in a corporate environment and not bringing that home and snapping. You know what I mean?
That's
the realities of it. Or if I do snap, you know, having the repercussions, because everything I do, not just dependent on me, it's a domino effect with the wife and the kids in the house, you know. If you've lost your job and you're on unemployment, you know, how do you navigate through that piece? Yeah. Because I've experienced all of that, there's one thing that's been consistent, that's God at the end of the day. You know what I mean? Throughout that, you know, I can always go to him, hey, listen, I fell short today. Or, you know, thank you. That was a great win that we did. So,
You know,
brothers like you, you know, girl, we just met each other. We sat there in Starbucks. You would have thought that you and I known each other a long time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's a natural connection. That's not by accident. I don't believe in coincidences. I believe that things happen for a reason.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as you were talking there, I remember Jamie Dimon, when I was at Morehouse, he came to visit and he speaks openly about the time he was fired.
Yeah.
And, you know, he kind of walked everybody through that whole thing. And I sat there and I said to myself, when I look at him now and where he is, it's like what you said earlier, he took risks.
Yeah.
I remember when I was working at United Negro College Fund, he was on the board. I think he was still at Bank One then. He had just left Citibank. Mm-hmm. But and now to see where he is. But, you know, in our community, but young people today, they have more options. They have more things at their fingertips. Mm-hmm. I want to find the right word here. How do you get them to see what they have. I struggle with that a little bit because there's so many things. You mentioned passion and so on. And you talk a lot to young people, obviously, and the work that you do today, you have to be kind of always thinking. You're always on. Folks like you can really ever be off. That's my humble opinion. But how would you get them to see it?
So you got to model it at the end of the day. You know, but to your point, you got to model it. But I think that to be very empathetic, it's nothing wrong with being transparent. I mean, respect is earned at the end of the day. It's funny because we always say, like, we can tell our kids a billion things. Somebody outside, they come say it one time and they get it. You know, it's like, right. There's a connection. It's like that. I'm going to write a book about that at some point. I'm hoarse. I've told you this a thousand times. And, you know, you just never. So I think it's about how do you model? How do you create a healthy? I mean, like motivation. I don't believe I can motivate anybody, but I can create a motivating environment. So when I think about and being unjudgmental, because I don't claim to be the smartest, but when you start looking at, especially young people now, they're brilliant at the end of the day. They don't read manuals. They just get it. So how do you harvest that? How do you see the beauty in that? You know, how do you be vulnerable and say, I don't know? You know, how do you, you know, teach them that titles does not grant you immunity? Because I'm your dad or I'm your superior, I shouldn't be able to talk to you any kind of way. How do you value them? You know? How do you make that connection at the end of the day? You're getting ready to leave here and go to a swim meet. You're a track star. You see what I'm saying? So by you just being there, that support and he seeing you there, that matters at the end of the day.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of being present. And that's the same thing with marriage and everything else, you know, and that's a constant. We've been married like 32 years. I'm still working on that. You know, how do you listen at the end of the day?
Yeah.
I think that matters. But also, how do you be disciplined? You know, because you've been on this planet or we have been on this planet longer than they have. There's some value in that. Yeah. Sometimes they'll listen. Sometimes they won't. You know what I mean? So, I don't know. You know,
you just said something that you just blew right by it, but I got to go back to it. You said you don't think you can motivate anyone, but create an environment that's motivating.
Yeah.
Now that pushes back against everything that you see in self-help books and all these things. So can you just tease that out a little bit more for me? I want to just see if I can track along with what your thought is there.
No, sure. You're right. You look at all these books and I've read a lot of, but that didn't matter to me. You know, like on leadership, it's like to me, an individual is going to make a decision. How do I create a motivated and all the success that I've had, if you want to call it that. It's not because of my title, again, because that didn't grant me immunity, you know, at the end of the day. You know, that's a sail against versus a tail. To me, it's like, how do I create, from a sustainability standpoint, a motivating environment? You know what I mean? At home, how do I, you know, if I'm, you know, you're reporting to me and I tell you to do something, you got to do it because it comes with the business card. But from a sustainability, or are you going to be most productive if I force you to do it? How do you create a motivating environment? I've always stated that, you know, and that's been proven, not just in the corporate world, all the success that I've had there, it's just in life. You know what I mean? How do I create a motivating environment where people feel comfortable being very transparent and being able to produce, being able to be their authentic self? That's what I love about diversity, equity, and inclusion. They throw that around lightly, you know what I mean, at the end of the day, because I've studied it and lived it and been in it, and I understand how it works. It's not that hard, you know, at the end of the day, creating a motivating environment. Sometimes that means pushing against the grain, you know, in a lot of ways. What's right, what's wrong, what's different, or why not at the end of the day?
So all of these companies that you've worked for, Amazon, Starbucks, Mobile, and all of these companies, does that philosophy still work in every one of them? The environment is more important than the actual, what I would call push and pull of management. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, I would never say, because companies going to do what they say they're going to do. What works for the individual was me. That's my philosophy at the end of the day. And even if that was different from their mission statement and vision, for me, I knew that as a person would work for me. My life experience has taught me that. Some organizations may not believe that. You know, specifically traditional organizations, that it's my way, our way, that the whole hierarchy and everything else, that's But for me, that I have, that's been proven to be successful because I've worked up under other things where people try to force you to do something, or because they had a title, they wanted you to do whatever. And then, like you said, there's organizations that I've had to leave because, or been fired because of what I believe in, you know, at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And I had one organization, I can't say, but they said, hey, listen, you know, we thought you were praying with your employees. I'm just having a conversation with them. They feel comfortable in talking with me. What do you mean? You know, so it's, you know, for me, it's, no, I think that's an individual choice. And I think for me, also, again, we talked about this before, using whatever platform God has given me to do that, to make sure it is a motivating environment.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
But you got to have thick skin. Everybody ain't going to do that. That gets back to your earlier question. Some people will compromise who they are and whose they are for whatever. Or, you know, for acceleration within the organization, for financial gain, for whatever.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you know.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I told you this hour would run by quick. I got two more questions to ask, two more things I want to ask you. So in your current role today, can you tell us a little bit about it and what do you do and how you're still living out what your ethos is, if you will?
Yeah. So, yeah, in my current role on the philanthropy side for the Morris Children Healthcare. So there's a population, there's two sectors. So you look at pediatrics and you start looking at geriatrics. You know, geriatrics, you know, my heart, I spend a lot of time working with geriatric patients with the pharmaceutical companies. That's almost, I don't want to call it, they're being lost in this world. You look at COVID, they don't understand a lot of this stuff. How do you continue to service them? In my current world, working in philanthropy with the Morris Children Hospital, I think it's gratifying because there's the need. You know, you start looking at, again, I look at health equity. When I talk about health equity, I think about the underserved populations, people that don't know that there's free healthcare out there for you. And when you start looking at pediatrics and you're looking at, you know, generational health kids growing, how do you get involved with their lives? So that's satisfying because I can make an imprint on educating people that don't know that there is help available for them, as well as grow the organization. You know, your second question was, what was your second question?
I mean, how do you live out your ethos?
Don't change. It don't change. Because
don't change.
For me, it don't change. I told them before I took the opportunity, I said, you go through these interviews and all that. I went and sat in the lobby. When I watch these people and parents come in there with bags up under their eyes and their clothes are wrinkled and they look distraught. And then I watch them leave out of there with some glimmer of hope at the end of that ain't, you know, that they don't tell you to do that at the end of the day. I can get behind this because it's making a difference. When I saw the diversity of kids, you know, coming in and out of there, you know, feeling better. When I walk in these wards and see these physicians doing the best that they can to help a diverse group of people, that matters with me. They didn't tell me to do that. And quite frankly, Gerald, every organization I've worked with, I've done that. You know, Starbucks. I wanted to go deep. I wanted to see what's underneath the green tent because then that matters to me. I walk the streets at nighttime. That's funny. And I know we got to go.
No, that's all right.
In my role at Starbucks. So I did a business development side. Then I got a promotion to DC. Everybody who's anybody got to go to the White House. They want to be close there. All the organizations, Bezos, whatever. So I had, you know, Washington, DC. So in my role, traditionally, a lot of directors don't go into the field. I lived in the field. You know, I get on the Metro. You know, I wanted to see what it's like for those stores to be closed and open and those young folks to leave out of there. And they got to step over homeless people and drug addicts and so forth. You know, I wanted to see what was going on. You know, I purposely would do that because I didn't ever want to lose touch for what my mission was at the end of the day. Yeah, it's driving performance. That's table stakes. You got to drive performance, drive sales and everything else. But to me, it was deeper in that. And then, you know, by my interaction with the city, with the people, you know, knowing that they're going to be okay, you know, talking with them, that's a partnership. That's how you earn that credibility. You've invested in that emotional bank account because you've been there and that's real. So when I left there, I felt good about the difference that I made, you know, at the end of the day for the right reasons. So yeah, I'm like you in that sense, you know.
Amazon was the same thing. You're just consistent.
Well, yeah, Amazon different because I was in the global role and it was when you got North America and this, it was in a virtual environment. Now, when you've got North America and then you got here, one of the things to me was that the growth is there's not one answer for everything. I mean, I had a question that was posed to me. Well, you know, Philip, what is the organization's stance on systemic apartheid in Palestine? I'm not from Palestine. So what I did is bridge a relationship with folks in Palestine to find out what was going on. And this is my statement. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So being authentic, not just a candid statement, you know, it's just about connecting with people and valuing what you have, you know?
Yeah. Well, my brother, this is the last question that I'd ask. And I've asked this of many of my guests, from Andrew Young to Otis Moss, Claude Alexander, and others, is when you look around you today, and all that you've shared with us today, your early years, your growing up, your station in life today, you know, your dad, a husband, and all these things that you see, a corporate executive, from a pastoral perspective, what words of hope and inspiration can you leave with the audience so they know a little bit more about, hey, look, you know, weeping indoors for a night, but joy is in the morning. What would you say?
Yeah. Well, I don't know what the pastors would say, but I would say this. I would say continue to lean in and lean on and push through. You know, with God, we're continue to lean in, to lean on, and to push through. At the end of the day, to your point, weeping comes short. And then I would say, with every beat of your heart, find a quiet space and know that God is with you. You know, at the end of the day, right? We're talking now. I just took a breath. I had no control over that. God is there at the end of the day. You know, you're a beautiful brother, man. I know we got to go. I certainly appreciate you not only doing this. I don't know how it's going to come. I hope that the time that we spent will touch one person at the end of the day. You know what I mean? Or one thing that you and I collectively have stated that helped somebody else. Because that's what it's all about at the end of the day. That's why we do this. This journey, I'm super excited about being on this journey with you. I look at you as a mentor, as a good brother too. One of the things that I talked about is having other people around. This matters at the end of the day. You know, what you and I are doing matters. You know, so I'm super excited about how God is going to continue to have this to blossom, brother.
Well, thank you, sir. And I will tell you, it has been, I am an accountant and a CPA. I am not a journalist. I didn't go to communication school. I tell people all the time, it is what it is.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to keep doing this. And I hope that we'll, you know, as our schedules move around here in the city, that we'll have an opportunity to meet and share and have our wives meet, yeah, and so on and so forth. But I really do appreciate you joining today, and your journey is no different than the others. And quite frankly, it is one that I know I'm going to get one or two phone calls about this interview. It's the authenticity of the guests,
yeah,
is what I'm told most that people can relate to. And I just want to say thank you for doing that for us today. It is greatly appreciated, sir.
No, brother, that goes both ways. And then we need to be intentional. We keep on talking about it. When we get off here, we need to get on the calendar.
We need to get on the calendar.
We can't, you know, procrastinate like that. We need to do that because nobody promised tomorrow. But no, brother, I appreciate you. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Great. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we just spent an hour with Mr. Philip Laws, and you heard a story and a journey. And as always, we hope that something was said, something was shared here today that picked at your heart, pricked your heart, or piqued your interest, whatever it may be, for you to see where your challenges are and say, hey, you know what? I can get to the other side of this. As Mr. Law says, he took that breath. He didn't control that breath, but he's still here. And as long as we're here, we have another chance. So with that, remember, this is It's Easy, Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. Until next week, take care and God bless.
God bless you.